You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe.
This week, Kentucky Senator Julie Denton accused Medicaid managed care organization Coventry Cares of underpaying hospitals, and that if the organization didn't straighten up, that she'd have the state end its contract with the company. That story took up much of Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Kenny Colston's time this week. He speaks with Rick Hallett about the dust-up. He begins by describing an MCO's role.
Basically, they take over the day-to-day operations that usually you see your state government does. It's private companies. They're the ones who take the bills from doctors who they don't necessarily set the rates, but talk about rates. They're the ones who do the day-to-day stuff. It's like hiring a bunch of secretaries for the state cabinet to manage Medicaid. They're the ones who get billed for procedures. They're the ones who pay back for procedures. They do all that work.
And these companies were brought on board to save money because the Medicaid program was just out of control.
Right? Yeah, I mean, the Medicaid budget was basically strangling Kentucky's state budget in terms of how much it cost. And even though they get help from the federal government, it was still just a big burden on the state. So this is designed to save money for the state. There's three statewide managed care operators that have been operating since September, but the idea isn't necessarily new. I mean, here in Louisville, Passport's been operating for more than a decade, and Lexington at one time had a managed care company that ended up failing. So not necessarily a new idea, new in the sense that statewide, it's on a big scale.
So that brings us to Coventry Cares and what's going on with this company.
Coventry is seemed to be arguing with everybody this week. They're telling a bunch of different hospital chains in eastern Kentucky, you know, in Ashland, in Elizabethtown, in the Baptist Health System Networks, which is Louisville and Lexington, that they either can't negotiate for a contract or they want to restart contract talks. And basically, these hospitals are saying Coventry wants more money. They were given bad information from the state. When all these MCOs started statewide, the state rushed it, gave them bad information, and they are not making money. And these are private companies. They're in the business of making money. So what they're doing is they're coming back to the hospital, knowing they're not going to get any more money from the state because the state wants to hit a certain projected savings. They're going back to the hospitals and saying, listen, we're going to pay you less, or you have to take less, you have to pay us more. And the hospitals are saying, we can't do that, you know, because then you talk about, you know, in Appalachian Regional's case, no coverage for Eastern Kentucky, a big hospital chain out there where most Medicaid patients are. You're talking about reduced services to patients because hospitals can't do those services if they're not getting paid for them. It's just a big mess. Coventry is basically telling everybody, listen, we need to hit the reset button. And everybody's saying, hold on a minute. We cannot hit the reset button.
And at least one lawmaker is threatening to give Coventry the boot if they keep this up.
That's right. State Senator Julie Denton, who is the chairwoman of the Senate Health and Welfare Committee, has basically joined House Speaker Greg Stumbo, who Stumbo said that he believes Coventry may be committing Medicaid fraud. Denton's taken it one step further and said that if these things don't get resolved by January 2013, when the legislature comes back for their odd year session, they're going to reopen the bill that created the statewide MCO process, and they're going to kick Coventry out. They're going to send that company packing and saying you cannot participate in our statewide MCO system.
So can these issues be resolved?
They can be. It depends on if people want them to be. I mean, Coventry obviously is a private business, like we've talked about. They want to make money. Would they rather be forcibly kicked out of the state that they're not making money in because they're profitable everywhere else? Or would they rather make things work? That's up to Coventry. They're not revealing their hand on that. Do the hospitals decide that, hey, listen, we're not going to be as profitable ourselves, or coverage is going to be reduced in order to get these contracts? I don't think hospitals are going to say we're going to care for our patients less. And then it's up to the state. Are they going to get in and really force one hand or the other, or force both sides to make things work? At the end of the day, it comes back to the state. It's their program that they've instituted. In the end, they're responsible, according to the federal government, for the Medicaid program. If the Cabinet for Health and Family Services wants the statewide, and the Beshear administration wants statewide MCOs to work, they're going to make sure it works.
All right. Kenny Colston is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sweeping budget cuts have forced the state judiciary to turn to furloughs, program cuts, and possible layoffs, mostly unseen in Kentucky courts. WKMS's Drew Adams delves into the cost-saving measures, some of which hurt working professionals more than judges.
Some of Callaway County's 12 deputy court clerks enter data at their desks and file paperwork in massive filing cabinets, while others assist county residents at walk-up windows. The clerks, like many, are leery of the state budget, which cuts most state agencies' funding 8.4%. This budget is unique because it reaches deep into the coffers of other governmental branches, namely the state judiciary. This fiscal year, the courts received the full brunt of the cut. Kentucky Chief Justice John Minton says the budget thinning on this level is unprecedented.
This is the first time in the history of the Commonwealth that the courtrooms of this state will be dark because there's not been enough money to fund the operation of courts.
Minton's office is responsible for administering the budget. He says he was forced to cut costs wherever he could.
I was confronted with whether deeper cuts, including people losing their jobs, would happen. And so the lesser of the evils was the temporary furlough situation.
So he instated three furlough days in the first half of the 2012 and 13 fiscal year. With 86% of his budget going to salary and benefits, there was no other place to cut but within the professional staff.
We've given up of just about all we can give, and now all we can give is people. And we've cut fat, but we're now cutting bone. That is the people that run the court system.
A second hardship stems from the fact all elected judicial employees, like judges, county clerks, and state attorneys, are immune from the furloughs. The state constitution forbids elected officials from having their income reduced while in office. Only the non-elected working professionals would feel the pinch. But Minton wants to set an example for the other elected officials.
I believe it is my responsibility as the leader, if you will, of the court system, that I'm going to donate the 3 days, just like the rest of the court system is going to do. I can't have my pay docked, but I can voluntarily give it back to the state. And so that's what I'm going to do.
While judges will be paid, court officers will be furloughed. As a result, courthouses across the state won't process legal paperwork, issue driver's licenses, or hold trials in both civil and criminal court. But law enforcement will not stop arresting people, and legal briefs will continue to be written. So professionals like those in Callaway County Clerk Linda Avery's office will have to cram more work into less time.
You know, we do what we have to do. It doesn't matter how many days we have to do it in, we have the same amount of work. We just have to get it done. And if we don't get our work done, then the public suffers.
Avery's 12 deputy county clerks are among those to feel the bite of the furloughs. While she is an elected official serving a 6-year term, her staff is a dedicated group of non-elected professionals whom the Chief Justice already considers underpaid.
Our deputy clerks and the judicial secretaries are operating at salary levels that are frankly at or below the federal minimum poverty line. So three unpaid days really creates a financial burden for them.
The cuts and furloughs in place only address the shortfall for the next 6 months of the 2-year budget. The Chief Justice still has to find a way to balance the budget over the next 18 months. For WKMS, I'm Drew Adams.
More than 1,300 students leave Murray State University this weekend with degrees in hand, most of them searching for a job. Their competition, nearly 2.5 million students graduating nationwide. Sheila Clark is the director of the West Kentucky Workforce Investment Board. Gary Pitts spoke with her about regional job prospects as the nation slowly pulls itself out of an economic recession.
We're coming up on graduation, and the nation as a whole and in our area, we're recovering from a recession, and there's some debate as to how that recovery is going. In our region, how are we doing as far as jobs are concerned?
Well, I think that we're in the middle of the pack, I would say. I would say that we probably have a few more opportunities just by having some of our areas that have a divergent economy rather than only having manufacturing in some areas, as some of our northern cities have seen. We do have a mix of our economies, and I think that's kept some of our counties in the middle of the pack as far as seeing the 8% and 9% unemployment. But some of the purchase counties have been down below that in their unemployment numbers. So there are a few more opportunities there. But each year, we have about 2.4 million graduates in the U.S. that suddenly come out and are competing for jobs. And it's a rude awakening when they've worked 4 years or oftentimes more in trying to get a college degree in a specific area of study. And then sometimes they find that that's not the area that everybody's looking at right now.
So right now, what area is everyone looking at?
Well, the areas that I think that we're seeing in this area, of course, education and that arena is always something that's being looked at. Teachers are always placed. Sometimes they're difficult in finding the right placement for them or job opening at the right time. But there's always a demand that's being shown there. And then we have our healthcare areas. We have individuals that are going through either short-term training or four-year training and coming out and buying for jobs there, and there is a high demand there. And then we have some of our other sectors that relate to finance, relate to logistics, transportation, some of the industrial and manufacturing, light manufacturing that we have in our area, and some of the engineering components that go with that as well.
Have you noticed that more students have started coming out with those degrees? Has there been a shift as to what students are majoring in?
I think that we've had more people interested, especially some of the dislocated workers that are trying to find their way back into the job market. Maybe they were in a factory for, 15 years, and in the second half of their labor, they're looking at an area where they feel like they have a greater chance of staying in one occupational area and not having that career leave them. A lot of times the healthcare fields, physical therapy, respiratory therapy, many of those areas, it's not just nursing, but it's something that pertains to a needed area, and it's a high-paying job, and there's not a lot of people that have flooded that particular market.
Looking at college graduates specifically, we talked some about fields that are always in demand, but what about those that are graduating and they're finding themselves having to work part-time jobs and they can't find anything with their degree? What degree are they holding?
Well, right now it could be a variety of degrees just because there's so much uncertainty in the job market, and sometimes we have employers that are saying, well, I'm not sure I can hire three people. Maybe I should only hire one, and maybe I can look at one this fall. So I think what we have to do is that makes the job hunter have to be a little more creative in trying to anticipate what that employer is looking for and trying to think about, well, yes, I did take a course in that, and yes, I did do a presentation on that. I don't have a lot of experience, but I enjoyed doing it, and I got a good grade. Sometimes you have to look at the little things that you've done to try to sell yourself there, because otherwise you're just one of 15 pages of people that have a master's in business.
Gary Pitt spoke with West Kentucky Workforce Investment Board Director Sheila Clark. Next, a new online initiative seeks to expand our political options, and residents in Ballard and Carlisle counties christen their new library. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. We're in Triple Crown season with the Preakness next Saturday. Some of the finest equine healthcare in the world is centered here in Kentucky. And advances in veterinary medicine give those who can afford it an edge on the track. Kentucky Public Radio's Leslie Gutman reports.
From the ceiling of a surgery suite, an 800-pound thoroughbred, slumbering under anesthesia, dangles upside down from a crane. Techs and nurses carefully lower the colt to a double-wide gurney. Then he's hooked up to a ventilator, delivering oxygen and anesthesia. Dr. Katie Garrett of Reed-and-Riddle Equine Hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, does an ultrasound, showing intern Sarah Peters where to inject an expensive stem cell treatment into the colt's pasterns.
See how we're going right to that gap in the bone? See that? So we're right in the fracture line? Okay, Sarah, we're good for the first one.
Thoroughbred racing is a multi-billion dollar industry, and equine veterinary care has become extremely sophisticated. Two of the world's top horse hospitals are in Lexington. Dr. Katie Garrett says medical advances are opening up new terrain for equine vets.
It's very rewarding to try something new and actually have it work, or think about something that you can diagnose now that you couldn't diagnose 10 years ago, or saving an animal's life that you are pretty sure you couldn't have saved 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, it's very exciting.
Veterinary care and racing today is competitive. Thoroughbred owners expect a lot and get it. Things like MRI results and blood work are often delivered within 24 hours, unlike the days and weeks that a human patient may wait. A chestnut mare is greeted by two stallions at Lane's End Farm near Lexington. Lane's End spent $2 million last year on vet care. Farm manager Mike Klein.
We have a repro guy that comes every morning and helps us figure out when we're going to breed mares and what days we're going to breed them on. And then we have a medicine person that takes care of sick foals and sick yearlings. And then we have an orthopedic vet that takes care of orthopedic issues.
These are very effective. They're also very expensive.
Sarah Wells has a handful of mares and one filly in training to race. Wells spends $10,000 to $12,000 of a roughly $60,000 yearly income on routine vet care.
And if you have a major surgery, like had a colic surgery a couple of 3 years ago, that's another $5,000.
Small-timers like Wells cannot afford horses of the quality that the million-dollar farms are buying. But they all dream of winning a big race with a dark horse, and more than one has done it. Top vet care can help make that happen, says Wells.
You sacrifice a lot. You don't do a lot of steak dinners, and you don't drive fancy cars.
On U.S. tracks each year, hundreds of horses die from race-related injuries. But for owners with the money and the will, options exist for saving some of them.
He's walking great.
Back at Reed-and-Riddle, hospital tech Sherry Miller walks a coffee-colored gelding toward a waiting van. His name is Arson Squad.
40 years ago, he wouldn't have had a shot. Would have been euthanized at the site.
Arson Squad broke down during training. He won't race again, but he won't have to be euthanized. That's thanks to an advanced procedure invented by Reed-and-Riddle surgeon Dr. Larry Bramlage. Arson Squad's bill is $15,000. In the parking lot, tech Sherry Miller is ready to load the horse into the van.
You be a good boy and do well. I'll come see you.
Arson Squad's on his way to a new life at an equine retirement home nearby called Old Friends.
Thank you very much.
For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Leslie Gutman.
Kentuckians might be among the majority of states to see a third-party candidate for president on the ballot this fall. It's also possible that the candidate will be the product of the nation's first-ever online primary. The nonprofit Americans Elect has spearheaded the program. National Campus Director Blake Wright joins me to talk about how the whole thing works. Blake, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, just explain to me what prompted this program Americans Elect.
Well, Americans Elect was started by members of both parties all across the nation who were fed up with the way in which the two parties were governing. For many, many years, two parties functioned well to get things done in Congress and on the presidential level. But now many Americans are dissatisfied with Congress. Right now there's a 9% approval rating for Congress just because the two parties are not getting things done. And so I felt that the system needed to be shaken up and that we needed a more democratic way to nominate because the two parties have sort of a monopoly hold on who we get to vote for president. So Americans Elect came together to give Americans a better way to nominate a president and to sort of use 21st century technology and update the election process.
Yeah, tell me how that works. How do you use that technology?
Well, you go onto our website at AmericansElect.org. You sign up to be a delegate. Any registered voter can do that. And you go on, you set your issues that you define what is important to you. You go on and you look at candidates who do the same thing. They answer a bank of questions and they get on there and they let you know what their issues are and what they believe. And you go on the website and in the coming weeks, we will have caucus rounds where you can vote, give support clicks to certain candidates and then vote in our primary rounds to have that nominee for president on the ballot.
And this all takes place in June. Is that whenever you will finally solidify who the candidate will be?
The final selection will be in June, but we have our first caucus round coming up on May 15th.
And it looks like you have different types of candidates. You have candidates that have declared, and then you have draft candidates. Can you tell me what draft candidates are?
Well, we really believe that it's not for any one organization to choose who our president is. It's for Americans to do that. So you can go onto our website and start draft movement for whomever you believe should be our president. And if you get enough support behind them, that draft candidate, you know, will be on our ballot. And if that individual chooses to run on the Americans Elect ballot, they will be there and they will be drafted by the everyday American citizen and not by a party.
And we're looking at your number one top draft candidate right now as being Representative Ron Paul. Does Ron Paul, if he is selected as the Americans Elect candidate, would he have to agree to be on the ballot, or could he be on there without agreeing to that?
He will not be on our primary ballot unless he declares as a candidate for Americans Elect.
How do you verify if someone is a registered voter whenever they sign up to be a delegate?
Well, we have a very secure verification process. The website itself was actually designed by members who started E-Trade, so it's a very secure website. You go on and you answer a bank of security questions performed by a third-party company, so we do not know these questions, and that will verify you as a registered voter.
And how many delegates do you have right now registered with Americans Elect?
We have just over 400,000.
For each and every state, you have to submit a petition, right, to be considered on the ballot in November?
Yes. We go state by state. Every state has different requirements. For example, California needed 900,000 signatures. We went out and got 1.6 million, which is one of the largest signature gatherings in the history of the United States, and it's the largest signature gathering in California. In Kentucky, it's 5,000 signatures, so we're hoping to gather around 10,000. But each state has different requirements, and we're going state by state meeting those legal requirements.
Who funds the program?
Many of our donors are anonymous, and some have come forward, but it's also funded by people like you and me who go on the website and donate.
Is there any pressure for you to reveal your donors?
Yes, there has been pressure for us to reveal our donors, even by some of the candidates running. But the nature of the organization being a 501c4 is that we don't, and we actually can't. It's up to the individual donor to reveal who they are.
Now, once the candidate is selected by Americans Elect in June, will this particular organization get behind that candidate by way of campaigning for or funding?
Once the candidate and their vice president are chosen by the Americans Elect delegates, Americans Elect completely steps out.
Your number one declared candidate right now, which could change, is Buddy Romer, who's a former governor of Louisiana, which isn't necessarily someone that has national appeal at the moment. What kind of impact do you expect Americans Elect to have on the fall election?
Well, if you look at a candidate like Buddy Romer, it's it's for him to have that national skill. You know, the two parties do a very good job of advertising who their candidates are. The Americans Elect candidate will be on the ballot in all 50 states, and it will be up to them to get their name out there. But if you look at a few of our candidates, for example, our top declared candidate, Buddy Romer, he's polling 7% nationally. Any of our candidates who get to a 15% mark nationally will be required to be in the televised presidential debates, and that will get them great coverage.
Blake Wright, National Campus Director for Americans Elect. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
After several years of planning, Ballard and Carlisle County residents will have access to their own library. The Ballard-Carlisle Library has opened with funds supplied by the Ballard Fiscal Court. Shelley Baskin spoke with librarian Sonia Maynard about the services the new library will provide for patrons.
This library project, how did it get started in the region?
Well, it started several years ago. There was no libraries in the county, so we started a bookmobile route to all the little towns and schools and senior citizen centers and daycares, and that's how it really started for Ballard and Carlisle. Since then, Ballard took on the responsibility to have a library, and the library is maintained by the Ballard County Fiscal Court, and we were in a church building that had gotten in very bad shape. The church building was over 125 years old, so it was in such a state that we just needed to get a new building.
And so now that the library is up and running, what kind of resources do you offer at the library?
Well, we have all materials in adult fiction and nonfiction and junior and young adults. We're starting a new young adult area. We have easies for the little ones. We have paperbacks, DVDs. We have two public access computers. We have basically what you find in most libraries. Ours is just on a smaller scale.
And so what's been the community's response to the library since the new one opened?
Well, they love it. We had an open house on May the 4th. We had over probably 100 people that came, and everyone was excited and happy and just really enjoyed it.
I understand that your library probably doesn't have the resources, the same resources as a lot of libraries, but are there any plans to offer continuing education programs at the library?
Well, we're not ruling anything out. We would like to be able to do that at some point and offer things not only for adults but for children too. I am one person, and I do it all. I run the bookmobile and the library with a couple of volunteers. So one person can only do so much, but we're hoping that in time perhaps monies would be available where we could offer some things like that, because we do have a nice facility for them to come to. So we're not ruling it out. We're hoping we can do things like that.
And other than those kind of programs, are there any other plans for expansion of the library as time goes on?
We would like to be so busy here at this library that, yes, we would have to build a huge building to house everything we need and hold all the people that would come to it. You know, right now we're just happy to be in a nice facility and offer the very best that we can for our patrons. And if the future holds something bigger, then we're happy to go with that, too.
Well, Sonia, I appreciate you talking to me today, and I wish you good luck with the library.
Thank you very much.
The Ballard-Carlisle Library will be open Thursdays and Fridays from 9 to 4. Bookmobile service will continue in the region. When we come back, a look ahead to next week's Lower Town Arts and Music Festival in Paducah, and an area high school bids farewell to its longtime choral director. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. You're listening to Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. You're listening to the Quaby Sisters Band. It's made up of Grace, Sophia, and Hulda Quaby, as well as Joe McKenzie and Drew Phelps. The young Texans play triple fiddles in the country western style and have played with ensembles ranging from the Grand Ole Opry to the Reno Philharmonic Orchestra. They'll be visiting Paris, Tennessee at the Kreider Performing Arts Center next week. Rose Kristen Presson spoke with Sophia Quaby about life as a sister and musician.
Do you think that you have any advantages or different experiences as a band because you guys are sisters as opposed to other groups?
We have grown up together, so the availability of getting to play and sing together, practice together, plus, you know, we talk so similarly that we get each other confused when we're listening back to tapes. Grace will be like, oh, why did you say that, Hulda? And I'm like, that's me. It's pretty funny. So, you know, I think that helps with our blend and the way we pronounce things, and that helps us sing together for sure. So there are advantages like that.
What have you guys been working on lately?
Well, we've been doing a lot of touring since the beginning of the year. It's been really cool. We went to Scotland in January, and then we went on a three-week tour with some other bands in February and March, up and down the West Coast. Now we're kind of playing some jobs around Texas and just got back from California, but we're going to be home for a little while and starting to work on a new recording project. So hopefully going to get in the studio in a month or so.
Is there much of an audience for this kind of traditional American music in Europe?
There is, you know. We didn't really know what it was going to be like. We actually played at a really big country music festival in France, of all places, and that was a blast.
So I have been doing research on you guys, and I see a lot of the same names kind of listed over and over as your influences. Do you have any musical influences that don't fall into this, I guess, country genre?
We're influenced from all kinds of music. You know, it might be Patti LaBelle, it might be watching old Jackson 5 videos of Michael Jackson. It might be Jackie Wilson, the drummer for Marty Stewart, was telling me about him and looked him up and just absolutely blew me away. What a voice. But, you know, we have our standbys that we absolutely love, such as Ray Price and Connie Smith and Ella Fitzgerald and Bob Wills and Django Reinhardt and Stephan Gappelli, Duff Smith, Ben Asmussen, and there's just a whole lot of different influences that we might have not mentioned in some of the stuff you've read. But
what are you listening to now?
Well, I have my phone right here. I'm just going to, like, zip over and look what I've bought recently.
All right.
Okay, there's this one singer. She sang for Manhattan Transfer. She's a great singer. Her name is Janice Siegel. I'm really into Natalie Cole, Rosemary Clooney, and I just bought a Sven Asmussen record. And I think I mentioned Jackie Wilson. He's probably the most recent for me.
So do you guys have labels amongst yourself? Like, I'm thinking of how boy bands will be like, oh, he's the cute one or he's the mysterious one.
Well, that's funny you ask. Grace is definitely the most organized. She's more like type A, makes lists and does that kind of thing. And it's great because without her, I don't know where I would be. And I'm more of the free spirit, which is not always great, but, and Hulda, and I've got a little bit of Hulda. She's a very much free spirit, but she's super clean and organized.
Okay.
So I'm not that way, unfortunately. I have to learn from them.
Have you seen a growth musically or not in yourself and your bandmates since all of this took off?
Yeah, you know, it's a learning process. You're hopefully improving and learning as you go along. I'm a far cry from where I would like to be And music is something that even the best musicians will say, you never stop learning. You never get to a point where you can't get better. And I think that over the years, we've learned and still have a lot more.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. Georgia, my mind. Georgia, Georgia, a song of you.
The Quaby Sisters Band plays at the Kreiner Performing Arts Center in Paris Saturday, May 19th. For tickets and more information, visit WKMS.org.
The 2012 Lower Town Arts and Music Festival gets underway in Paducah next Friday. The three-day event brings together artists, musicians, and restaurants from the 350 miles around the River City. It also brings festival-goers from just as far. For a preview of what's new this year, we turn now to festival co-director and Lower Town artist, Michael Terra.
Why is this festival different from all other festivals?
What a great question. One of the things that makes this festival very different from most of the sorts of festivals that you'll go to and enjoy is that this festival is completely oriented to the richness that we have in our own region. Everything that you enjoy at this festival, the food, the beer, the wine, the art, the music, is all going to be from right around this area. So it's a big celebration of what is very cool about living where we live.
And it sounds as though there's a lot of very interesting new things coming up, different kinds of offerings from the Paducah Improv Group, improv training they're offering, balcony theater. And I'm curious to know, what is this culinary theater that we'll be seeing?
Culinary theater is a terrific idea that Patrick, who's the head of the culinary program over at Western Kentucky Technical College, and I cooked up, where we will have a stage, and his culinary students, and he will be on a daily basis choosing a theme and making food based around that theme and giving out samples for people to enjoy. And every day will be a different theme. So people are going to want to come back.
Well, what about kids? Is there something new for the kids this year?
Actually, there's a lot of stuff for the kids. Our kids' tent has expanded now to become over 40 feet long. So throughout the day, people will be able to sit under a shade tent and listen to Red Dog or someone like that right there at the kids' tent. It's going to be a pretty sweet deal. It's almost like a festival within a festival.
As you alluded to a little earlier, this is going to be a bigger taste of Paducah as well.
It is going to be a bigger taste of Paducah. We have, I think, 25% more restaurants participating. We've got, actually, Village Pizza has worked it out where they're going to be able to make hot pies and deliver them, you know, right away. And the new Rivertown Dogs people are going to be bringing some food. Cynthia's Artisan Kitchen, Buzzard Brothers, the Italian Water Ice people, and Hotel Metropolitan is going to be doing their wonderful fundraiser. So lots of good food and a good range of choices. What about the art? Can we talk about art?
Oh, no. Let's talk about the art.
As a professional artist, I like to talk about the art, but I also like to everything else. But we have grown substantially We've had many more artists apply to the show. We had really top-notch professional jurors this year, people who actually run shows in places like Chicago. So the artists that we have this year are totally top-notch. A really nice group of ceramic artists are here, photographers, painters, some very neat jewelry, wood. We have a guy who actually carves guitars, and he's going to be here. So I think that the art is going to be better than it's ever been, better quality and a huge range. It's just going to be totally exciting. The weather is supposed to be wonderful. Yeah, bring it in. Bring him on. Let's all get together and have fun.
Boudicca's 2012 Lower Town Arts and Music Festival begins at 3 p.m. this Friday and wraps up Sunday, May 20th at 5 in the evening. You can find more info at lowertownamf.com. Lower Town artist Michael Terra is festival co-director. Mr. Terra, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, Paducah, Paducah, if you want it, you can rhyme it with bazooka. But you can't do Paducah, because it's another word for paradise. Here we go, Josh Connor.
This month marks the end of an era for the choral program at Paducah Tillman High School. Longtime choir director and teacher Art Deweese is retiring after 22 years in the classroom. During his tenure, Deweese has shaped an award-winning choral program. His students have performed at New York's Carnegie Hall and even sung masses at St. Mark's in Venice, as well as the Vatican. The Grand Rivers native has also guided high school students to professional caliber vocal performances in three recent musicals at PTHS, Les Miserables, Jekyll and Hyde, and Fiddler on the Roof.
And how do we keep our balance? That I can tell you in one word. Tradition! 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 Tradition!
So I went to Paducah Tillman one sunny afternoon to speak to Art Deweese, a man who's become something of a tradition himself, about his career and his future.
Nice to meet you.
When you were growing up in Livingston County, what kind of music did you listen to?
Well, believe it or not, I was fortunate enough growing up there to have an incredible choral director, and really that's where I got my basis for what I do. I was through her inspiration. And really fine music, and listen to good music, and basically listen to classical music, started taking piano lessons at a young age. So I was involved in classical music from a very early age.
At what point did you go, I want to make this a career?
My freshman year of high school. Actually, between my eighth grade year and freshman year, but really my freshman year of high school, I knew that that's what I wanted to do.
Two of the of Tillman's choral groups have toured Italy, played the Vatican, played Carnegie Hall, won quite a number of awards under your direction. And I suppose would be very easy to cite as a highlight of your tenure. But outside of that, is there anything that you can point to as a highlight?
Well, of course, that trip to Italy, at Carnegie Hall, both of those were extremely high points and memorable experiences. We've traveled to Europe a number of times, and every time I would go, I would think, this can't be topped. Same thing with Carnegie Hall, and then the kids will turn around and they will top it. They manage to do something. And a lot of times it can happen in class. There is music that's made in rehearsal that really can't be reproduced. And so those moments come at special times, and they happen throughout the year and throughout the week. But as far as the performance goes, those would probably be two of the top performances.
Have you thought about some kind of, I don't want to say great lesson, but perhaps valedictory statement that you would have looking back at these years here?
Just the appreciation for being able to work in a school and a community. Paducah, the parents that I have been able to work with the 17 years I've been at Tillman have been an incredible source of inspiration and support. and for quality, and to be able to work in a school system and to be able to work at Buca Tillman that values the arts, that appreciates excellence. I think it causes you to strive as a teacher to do better. For me, it does, at least. Every day I step foot in the classroom, I try to do better than I did the day before. And being able to work in a system that and a community that has such a love and a support for the arts does nothing but validate what we do.
What prompted you to decide that now is the time?
Well, 27 years, my wife retired last year from education. She was here at Tillman as the director of curriculum, assistant principal. And we have two granddaughters and a grandson on the way. And I want to be able to go. I want to be able to leave my program when it's on top. And I've got a great group of kids this year. My freshman class is one of the strongest freshman classes I've had in my career at Tillman. And I don't want someone to come in and say, well, they can't do anything with it because they don't have anything to work with. That's not the case. And I don't want to outstay my welcome. I don't want people wanting to say, when is he leaving? I'd rather go out when they don't want me to go necessarily than when they want me to boot me out the door.
So what now?
I'll still be in Paducah. We'll be director of music at Broadway Baptist Church, actually. I've been at First Baptist Church for 23 years and will be making another life-changing change in just a few weeks.
How do you reach all of your kids?
I think it boils down to kids want to be challenged. They do not accept mediocrity. And I think that as long as we as educators continue to raise the bar, I attribute a lot of it to good literature. I don't sing trash. I don't do jump, shout, boogie, as I call it. They sing quality literature. They sing literature that a lot of college choirs can't sing and haven't sung. And so I think that giving them substance and challenging them daily has created that sense with them of wanting to do better. Of course, we were able to do three musicals, and that was a tremendous, that was also a very highlight of my career, too, the three musicals that we staged. Les Mis being the first musical that we staged. And that musical, there had not been a musical staged at Tillman probably for, I would say, maybe 20 years when we staged that show. And that opened another whole, world for a lot of the kids. And that has also been a plus. All three of the musicals that we've staged, I would put up against anybody anywhere, really. Honestly, I would. They would rival a lot of things that have been done at the Carson Center, in my opinion.
Written on the front of Paducah Tillman High School is the statement, "The culture of the ages is preserved for our use." And it could be said Art DeWeese's legacy is that for 22 years, he's worked to make those words sing to his students. Carson Center hosts a farewell to Art DeWeese choir concert performance this afternoon at 3. More information is available at 270-444-5650.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Seth Helton, Casey Northcutt, Gary Pitts, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lockey is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
If you have questions or comments about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say at our Facebook page, and there's a link to that page at our website, news.wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Join us Friday morning at 8:35 for Front Page AM and Friday evening at 6:30 for Front Page PM. Thanks for being with us.